From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about another film in our ongoing series. This one is not a documentary. It's a full-length feature that director Jim Cummings created out of his short film that was a sensation at Sundance a few years ago. A small-town police officer giving the eulogy for his mother ends up singing and dancing to a Bruce Springsteen classic. It's called Thunder Road. We're screening it next week, talking about it in just a moment.
They say all politics is local, and KUER reporters are here to bring you Utah stories, news that affects you here at home, like public lands and water issues, religion, and the tech boom. You can trust KUER to bring you the facts and thoughtful analysis of why the story matters. Listen to KUER on air at 90.1, stream us at KUER.org, and here's a pro tip. If you've got a smart speaker, tell it you want to listen to NPR, and Alexa or Google will take you right there.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Jim Cummings' short film Thunder Road was a huge hit at Sundance a few years ago. And people loved it because it was one of those times when something seemed to fit just perfectly into its space. Just under 13 minutes, it was compact, nothing too complicated, didn't need much of a backstory or any exposition. And this is it. There's a small-town cop in Texas with a police academy haircut, a mustache. He's in uniform, and he's giving a eulogy at his mother's funeral. Well, it's a disaster. He stumbles around, goes on these crying jags, tries to sing and then dance to Bruce Springsteen's Thunder Road. And there in the front pew, watching all of this, is his daughter, who's confused and humiliated. The film won a grand jury prize and received all kinds of raves. And now, Cummings has made a full-length feature out of the story. It won the grand jury award at South by Southwest last year. And it turns out when you see the longer version, the police officer, Jim Arnault is his name, is going through a difficult divorce and he's losing his daughter, her respect and affection, but also really losing her in a custody dispute. The film is also called Thunder Road, and it's the latest in our film series. We're going to be screening it next week. We'll give you the details about that a little bit later on the program. And I should also mention that in some of the clips we'll be playing, there's some strong language. Jim Cummings joined us from the studios of Marketplace in Los Angeles. And the first thing I asked him was, where did he get, you know, where did he find the character of Officer Jim Arnault?
I had the idea in a hot tub. I was with my buddy PJ, who's an actor, and he told me a story about a friend of his who was a performing arts major who sang a song at a funeral of a parent. And I thought, oh my God, how does that sound? It can't be a great, you know, song. I mean, he's going to be stressing out and grieving, and it could be so messy.
Yeah.
And I said, did somebody film that? I'd love to see what that looks like. And my buddy PJ said, no, why would somebody film that? And I was like, oh, yeah, that's a good point. But for a long time, it was just an idea for a monologue. And I just started doing it. I was driving to work, and I was thinking about if my mom passed away, what I would do and what I would say to, you know, everybody. And I heard Thunder Road on the radio, and I thought, this is it. I would do this song, and what if it was terrible? What if I just blew it? And that would also be very funny. And so I just started rehearsing it in my car on the drives to work. And very quickly, when I was performing it, I was doing a Southern accent. I'm from New Orleans, and yeah. So I grew up with people that spoke like that, but I don't have one. And I just realized how much more tragic it was. So, like, Jim, as a character, is just this empathy machine. Like, he's this dude where you just sympathize with him, and he has the best intentions and is just this terrible victim of circumstance.
Yeah.
And so everything from the short film on, even in the rehearsal of the short film, it was just something to get the audience to sympathize with this guy and laugh and also distract them with the comedy in order to talk about important stuff like mortality and life and love and legacy and all the good stuff.
I want to play a moment from that funeral scene, which is such an important, critical. I mean, it's in some ways it's like the climax, and you've chosen to put it at the beginning of the film, the feature film, which is really interesting. But let's start with that. Set this up for us. This is a moment when, in the eulogy, as we're getting to sort of the painful part of it, where he has a kid's boombox that he's brought up with him because he wants to play for the people. Thunder Road from Springsteen, and the boombox isn't working. Do we need to say anything more about this particular moment?
The opening shot is him bashing batteries into it, So it is kind of his own fault that it doesn't work. But That's the only setup that I'll give, yeah.
Yeah.
She used to sing Thunder Road to me when I was going to sleep. And I'm not a singer or dancer or, you know, anything. My daughter's a creative one. But people said it'd be a good idea if I brought it in, so... So I brought it in, and so I'm going to sing it. Okay. I had it working this morning, I promise. Come on, just work. Come on, please. Sorry. It's not gonna work. Could you do that? That'd be great. It's track four. Thank you so much. It's a beautiful song. How do you explain it? It's a song about this guy telling this girl to leave their small town forever, changed a lot. Should we just call the manufacturer? Changed a lot forever for the better. And my mom really loved it. It's not gonna work. No, he's saying it's not gonna work. I'm sorry. Well, typical. I don't even know if it's going to work without the song, to be honest with you, but I did a lot of planning for it, and I love my mom, and so I'm just going to do it, and I don't know what else to do, so.
Yeah.
Should we just call the manufacturer? It's so great. It's, had you written that, by the way?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, because there are moments when I'm looking at this, I'm like, because it seems so natural. Part of me wondered how much of this was improvised and how much of this was written out. And it gets to something I've heard you talk about, the writing process, is that you had to kind of perform it. I'm thinking about you driving, rehearsing this. So it was very much as you were writing it, performing it too, right? I mean, imagining how real these cadences are in the sentences themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Cadence is everything. And comedy is so performance-based. You can have an incredible punchline, and if it's not delivered properly, it fails. English is so complex. I realize, like, in that moment that we just heard, he says, somebody told me I should bring it in, so I brought it in. And, like, just that simple up and down of cadence and inflection on different words, it furthers the conversation.
Yeah.
And it's this interesting look into somebody's brain and how it's functioning. You see the wheels moving when somebody's speaking. And I find that so interesting. So I had to perform it 1,000 times. Yeah, like when I was driving or when I was writing it, it's just me looking like a lunatic, walking around, acting out every scene.
Yeah.
And very little of it on the day is improvised, almost none of it.
Yeah.
I mean, we didn't have a big budget. We didn't have a big schedule. We shot it in 14 and a half days in Austin, Texas. And in order to do that, everybody had to be on the same page. So I recorded the movie as a podcast. Similar to this, I was in my closet with a voice memo app on my iPhone, and I was just recording and playing every part. I was, you know, reading as a 9-year-old girl. I played my daughter in the film too, but I would send that to the cast and crew to get everybody on the same page of at least what the goal of each scene was, where the punchlines were, how I was imagining a baseline performance of it. And then I would put in music and sound design. So really, before anybody showed up on set, they'd have an idea of how the movie at least would sound and how it would flow. And it was great. I'm going to do it for all of my other films as well.
You know, it's interesting. What is so fascinating about Jim is that he will let go for a minute. He'll break down, as we heard in that particular moment, and then he'll immediately back off. And his face will change completely. Like, he's completely collapsed in tears, and then his face changes and everything dries up, like in seconds.
Yep. Yeah, in a millisecond.
Yeah.
It's so important, and like that's very funny to me. Like you see Michael Scott do that in The Office, or David Brent from The British Office, and that gives you an idea of what the person's thinking, and that's very funny. There's a moment in the movie during that eulogy, he starts crying and he goes, "I'm so sorry," and then his face straightens up and his back straightens up real quick, and that's him fighting between like being a human being that's okay to grieve. And then he's in front of his coworkers as a police officer. Yeah. And so he has this battle internally that shows in his face. And I find that equally very funny and sad and, descriptive of the society that he's in that forces him to not be vulnerable.
Yeah. You put it this way. You say Jim is one of those guys who spends his life being a spectator of his own experience rather than making any decisions.
Well, yeah, that's what Thunder Road is about.
Yeah.
Like the song is about stopping being a spectator and jumping in a car and being the decision makers of your future. And that's what that song means to so many millions of people, is saying I'm unhappy and admitting it and changing your life for the better. And that's why the movie has to be about that as well.
What's interesting to me, too, is that it's so – like the short is – kind of, and I think I've heard a lot of people say this, it's kind of perfect in that way. It's this one moment that is beautiful and really difficult to watch as well. And you see this in the course of like 12 and a half minutes, this thing play out. And in the end, we see this facial expression. We don't hear anything. And it's like complete, like it's complete. And then how do you make that a feature? Like, did you ever worry that I'm going to ruin this perfect thing?
Oh, dude, every day.
Yeah.
Every moment of every day.
Yeah.
For a long time, I said that it couldn't be turned into a feature, that would have to be the climax, like you said. It would have to be 60 minutes into the movie, and then the running up, you know, the previous 40 minutes would have to be him having a bad relationship with his mom, and then she dies. And I was like, this isn't going to be a good movie. It's going to be like 8 Mile. Like, and 8 Mile is incredible. I'm not going to be able to beat 8 Mile. And so, I don't know, for about a year after I had finished the short film, I thought, no, I couldn't. You couldn't turn it into a feature. And then I had the idea of starting it with the short film. And then the movie, I was like, well, what happens after that? If his daughter pulls away from him in the back pew, maybe the rest of the movie's about legacy and him repairing this cycle of bad parenting. And that's a great opportunity to do the heartfelt American living room, you know, Cameron Crowe style stuff, while also doing this Danny McBride Eastbound and Down style comedy. And Mike Judge, like King of the Hill style, complacent goofball dad, fuddy-duddy Southern dude in blue jeans and boots. And I was like, this is great. This could be awesome. And so I started writing it. And then but then after that, every moment of every day was me riddled with fear that it wasn't going to be as good as the short. And the short is really good.
Yeah.
It's like each moment is perfect. But I like the eulogy better in the feature. I think it's I watched the short film again recently, and it seems too quirky. It seems too quick. And then in the opening scene of the feature, it is this intense dude who probably shouldn't have a gun. And I don't know, maybe it was the 2 years gap of growing up a little bit and contextualizing what actually losing somebody is like, and doing research on the police, that, you know, this guy's John Wayne. This guy's is a real tough guy, and you kind of have to slow it down. And the audience is okay with it, and I was okay with it. And so,
I liked the eulogy in the feature better than the short too.
Okay, cool.
A lot better, and I think there were some moments too where it just seemed more mature as a character, which sounds like a weird thing to say, but like there's this moment where you have Crystal, you pick her up, and then you're looking at someone in the audience who we don't see, who is crying, and you say, "I'm sorry to make you cry. Your mascara is running. You look awful." And that almost made the moment itself, because he's this clumsy dude, and it was beautiful. I liked it better, too, I have to say.
I really love that moment. So I put that in because obviously we couldn't have the song, and so the eulogy had to be different.
Yeah.
But I put that part in because it's so funny, where it's like, and also I know that probably half the audience is going to be seeing this not as a comedy at all. They're going to be crying during that moment.
Yeah.
And so their mascara might be running.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of a comment on the film audience as well as the eulogy audience. And it always gets a laugh of somebody. Yeah, your mascara is all over the place. You look awful.
Yeah.
it's so rude first thing in the morning. It's great.
Yeah. I want to play another moment. This comes later in the film, but this is Jim, who is basically spends the rest of the film trying to explain this eulogy and explain why he thinks it worked okay, because basically he dances in it. He can't get the music to play. So I loved this too, by the way. And I have to say, I think it worked better without the music, because your body language in doing the dance and explaining what's going on in the song that they're not hearing made it even more excruciating.
It's a nosedive.
It's a nosedive.
And it's also having to contextualize a Bruce Springsteen song without being able to sing any of the lyrics.
Yep.
It's like,
yep.
How do you explain it? It's a very important song. I don't know. It's really funny. Yeah.
There's a moment when he it goes and speaks with his daughter, Crystal's teacher. I was going through a divorce, and his life is basically falling apart. But what's great about this scene is how he has this inclination to go off and then immediately regret it, but then keeps going and then backs off. This is the theme of his character in some way. This moment, Jim learns from the teacher that his daughter's having trouble reading. And Jim is dyslexic, so he knows that she got this from him.
Look, you can't blame Crystal for this kind of stuff. Even with the homework thing, she gets an assignment on a Monday. She does it, but she leaves it at her mom's house. I have her for the next few days. She doesn't get it to you for a week, sometimes weeks at a time. She gets demerits on it. That's a problem of living between two homes. Don't blame her for that. That's on us. She's a good student.
Well, she's also been exhibiting some pretty serious reading difficulties.
Well, now, that she would have gotten from me. I'm sorry.
Mr. Art.
You gotta give me a minute. I'm so sorry. I'm gonna have to hold on to this desk for a minute.
Please.
You gotta stop. You never wanna hear that. You never wanna hear you passed on something terrible to a child. Sorry. I'm gonna have to walk around for a second. Sorry.
Mr. Arnault?
You gotta stop that. You gotta stop talking to me, man. Shithead. I didn't mean to call you that. I'm sorry. That just came out. And now you think I'm probably the bad parent because I cursed in front of you. This whole thing was about her cursing. We danced around it for like 5 minutes. It was a nightmare. There I am. I cursed again.
Let's calm down.
Give me a demerit. See if I can give a shit, but I don't care. Dude, I will hum this desk across the room so fast.
I prefer you don't. That's Crystal's desk. Put the desk down. Please.
One of the things that is apparent in the film is that these expectations men from the South are wrestling with. You, as you said, you're from New Orleans, and you've talked about how it was kind of important for you to tell Southern family stories. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that, like the culture of the expectations of men in the South, and how Jim is dealing with that, wanting to express himself, but realizing I can't really, or I shouldn't really.
Yeah, I think it's this disease in American South culture with men particularly, where they are incapable of showing any vulnerability. And there's all kinds of psychological tests and studies that have gone on about this, and it's very it's well documented that the South, for whatever reason, people have a lot of difficulty of shirking any insult, and they're far more prone to disgust and many other things that happen at the level of the brain that separate men in the South from really anywhere else.
Yeah.
And I find that so interesting. I grew up in it, and so I was always looking at the—I was the videographer for the high school football team. Wow. I couldn't play myself, but I got to document a lot of these tough guys, and it's all theatrics. Like, all of this is—it's people who are human beings who are— who have love and care and sadness in their brains, and instead they choose to be these tough, straight-backed jerkwads at times, and are generally deeply inconsiderate of their place in the universe and how much time they have on this planet. And I just find that so interesting and funny. So if I can show the ultimate guy who can't talk about his problems or exhibit any kind of vulnerability, I really hope that that type of person will see it, male or female, and say, "Oh, I'm not going to be like that idiot. I'm gonna get help," or something like that. Like, you see Charlie Chaplin doing that kind of stuff, where he's able to play the tramp and the fool, and it converts people into a cleaner mindset than many other things can. Than attacking them, you got to humanize them first.
Yeah. Any part of Jim in you, do you think?
I always say he's just a far more pathetic version of me.
Yeah.
Or I don't know. Like, everybody has that. Everybody has those moments where they wish they hadn't said that thing out loud.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I mean, everybody's like that. But no, I'm not a dad. Both my parents are still alive, thankfully. I'm from the South. I'm not a police officer. I'm a hipster. I am a divorcee. That's probably the only thing that's close to me. But no, I think he's just this guy who's trying his best, and for many reasons that aren't his fault, can't.
Jim Cummings, he wrote, he directed, and he stars in Thunder Road, which we're screening next week. That's Wednesday night at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. The film starts at 7 o'clock. Cummings will be there for a Q&A after the film. This is part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with Utah Film Center. You can get all the details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
If you're about to part ways with your old car, consider donating it to KUER. We'll take your vehicle in almost any condition, and we'll even arrange to pick it up. The proceeds from your donation support the KUER programs you love, like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Radio West. Learn more about our vehicle donation program at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about another film in our ongoing series. This one is not a documentary. It's a full-length feature that the director Jim Cummings created out of his short film that was a sensation at Sundance a few years ago. It's called Thunder Road. I want to talk about short films because you've done
too many.
A lot. Yeah. You've done a good number. And I was just watching The Robbery this morning.
Oh, Jesus.
And like Thunder Road, it's shot in one take. And the challenges of doing that.
Yeah.
What is it that's appealing about the one take thing? Because The Robbery, you forget it. I mean, as a conceit, like, this is cool. This is one take. And then you forget and then you remember.
Yeah.
What is it about that that you love?
Exactly that. So psychologically, there's an experience that you have in watching something that is uninterrupted footage, where you become a voyeur and also, I don't know, present inside of the experience of the characters. And that's something that we've always wanted to do since the theater, but we've lost it. And I feel like a lot of short films, like if I'd done Thunder Road as a short film and it was edited conventionally, it would just be a weird short film at a funeral. But because it's this long zoom in and it's one uninterrupted shot, you are present with this guy and you are in the audience watching this person have a meltdown in a way that you would not have that same feeling if it was edited. So I love that. And then there's also like wonderful things that you can do where it doesn't feel preachy. You can talk about all of this big stuff while distracting the audience with the sleight of hand magic trick that is doing a long take.
Mm. I wondered about whether or not you see yourself as an actor first or a filmmaker first, because a lot of these shorts that I watched, most of them, you're not really in them. I have to say Thunder Road is a brilliant performance, but does he think of himself as an actor first or a filmmaker first?
Filmmaker, I think, is probably what I think of myself as. Like when I write something and it's something that I know that I can perform, or I can perform better than my group of friends, my like acting troupe that are always helping me out on stuff, I play the part. But I love being able to create opportunities for actors that are a showcase of their abilities. So like doing these long takes is that. It's just this platform with which to perform and complicate performance as much as possible. So I always start as a filmmaker and try to make something as impressive as possible for an audience. Of not only is it one uninterrupted shot where the girl's running around a convenience store, there's also a crossbow and a lot of arrows that are hitting her, and the ballet orchestra of surrounding her with production assistants squirting her with fake blood, and then she has to have a phone call that goes from speakerphone to regular phone, and she can't hear the conversation. It's like all of these spinning plates to put a character through for the audience afterwards. Go, oh my god, I can't believe they did that, or I can't believe she did that, and that's such a great feeling to have an audience say that about your movie, and I chase that feeling all the time.
Mm. Did you cast someone else for Jim originally?
Yeah, I did. I cast a guy who is a good friend of ours who had acted in a bunch of stuff that we had shot. It was like sketch comedy that we were doing in 2014. And he looks a lot more like a police officer. He's a really talented actor. And I liked working with him. I love working with him. But I realized in his rehearsal that it wasn't going to be funny, that it was just going to be tragic. And I was like, maybe we should do it like this. And I was like, all right, well, screw it. I'll just do it. And I'll film myself and I'll send it to y'all. And then I sent it to my producer. I filmed myself on an iPhone in my friend's basement doing the monologue of how I imagined it. And the cinematographer and the producer were like, no, dude, you got to do it. It's got to be you. And I was like, okay. I never really acted before. I was like, all right, I guess I'm going to grow my mustache out now and be a police officer. That's how I got cast in the part.
I want to come back to that question we were talking about before about Southern culture, because it's something that Jim brings up in this notorious parking lot scene in the film. set us up. What's he doing in the parking lot here? Because I want to play just a moment from this.
Okay, cool. So during the funeral scene, during the dance, Jim is filmed by an audience member on an iPhone, and the footage ends up leaking, and he loses his daughter. He loses custody to his daughter, and he's kind of destitute and very angry. Mm-hmm. And so he drives up into the parking lot to confront his partner, Nate. And it ends up becoming this nightmare of a shouting match between him taking off all of his clothes and shouting at the entire police force. And it's very funny and very intense.
Let me talk. Yeah, I'll talk. Ask me to talk, I'll talk all day today. I'm having. Yeah. You don't want me to talk. I got dirt on all of y'all. Shit. I'll be out here. Try getting off duty. I'll ruin the parking lot experience for all of you. I'll talk all night right here, mother. I'll start with myself. My wife left me a year and a half ago. There. Laugh it up. Does that change anything? No. Am I cured? Of course not. Talking about your problems never helped anybody, ever. I slept in my car. Right here. 3 weeks. Jerry saw it. Isn't that right, Jerry?
Yeah, I brought you breakfast.
Thank you so much for doing that, Jerry. That meant a lot back then. But you right now.
You're drunk.
I'm not drunk. I'm angry. I realize that. Calm down. I lost my daughter today. And I did everything right.
I love that line with Jerry, I have to say. And I'll ask it again. Did you? That was written, right?
Of course.
Okay.
Of course. Yeah. No, I just love that. That's like
being comedically sidetracked in the middle of something, and like you know, he's on this like directive to start shouting and be angry, and then somebody says, "I brought you breakfast." Like, what a nice thing to do to a guy who's going through a divorce, who's sleeping in his car, and then he stops himself and he goes, "Oh, thank you so much for doing that, Jerry." And he actually pivots, so he's walking in one direction, has to come back to talk to Jerry, and then he insults him again in front of everybody. It's just. Peppering in that stuff of painting the full world, it's so complicated and so funny. I just love that. Yeah, it has to be messy, and that's what people love. That's what life is. You know, when somebody has a public meltdown, it's not clean. It's like this goofball lunatic who is, you know, the people from the peanut gallery are chirping up the whole time. It's great.
I love these parts where he starts to say something and you don't know what he's going to say. Or he stops saying it, and you wonder, what was he going to say? Where was that going to go?
Yeah, I realized that in writing, English is so cool. But like, if you have somebody start a sentence, they don't have to finish it. If it's an idiom or a turn of phrase, you understand what he means. So like, he's talking to his daughter in the film, and he's seen his daughter, who's 9, hold hands with this kid, Tony. And he's nervous about it because he didn't know that she had a boyfriend. And he stops short in the car and he's like terrified. And he confronts her later and he says, is Tony a slicker? And he says, listen, honey, just you got to trust me. If you give a mouse a cookie, hey, I love you. And she's running away. And that just paints a picture in the mind of the audience of like what he is thinking is that Tony is after for far more than a handshake. That's what he wants. And it's just it's such a funny thing. You don't have to finish that sentence. You know where it's going. And Jim, you do that all the time. You're able to paint a picture of the cogs working inside of someone's mind. And I love that. It's so interesting. The audience becomes a detective of the story, and it's a joke. It's a punchline.
There is this brilliant bit of stage business that you do with Crystal. This hand slap game.
Yeah.
Which is another I saw as this kind of perfect little narrative within the film itself. He has to prove himself to her, and he's got to redeem himself for the funeral. I don't know if we want to give it up too much, but just say a little bit about this moment.
Sure. So it's the first night that Jim has Crystal back. It's joint custody, and so he has his calendar with, you know, the first night that she comes back. She comes down and they're having dinner and she's kind of berating him because he messed up this birthday party she got invited to and she missed it. And now she's losing face at school. And it's this, you know, it's a conversation at a dinner table that happens in a million American households with joint custody. It's hell. And then she says, do you know how to play patty cake? Do you know how to play the hand slap game? And he doesn't. And he's, you know, if you've seen this guy for the last 20 minutes of the movie, he's so uncoordinated and clumsy. There's no way he's going to be able to do it. And so she teaches him how to do it, and he's terrible. And then she says, oh, it's fine. And she stops. And he loses this battle of being a good parent.
Yeah.
And then she goes to bed, and he says, I love you, honey. And she doesn't say anything. And then it's the next morning and she's going to school and then she says, hey, can I talk to you about something? And he sits back down and she puts her hands up to play the hand slap game and he laughs. And the audience is like, oh, this is another battle. And he does the hand slap game and he's perfect at it.
Nails it.
Yeah. Absolutely perfect. And he's like the cool dad now. And she stands up to leave the scene and he picks up the telephone because Comcast is calling him or whatever. And he walks over to the wall and plucks down these two hands that are painted up on the wall because he stayed up all night. It's so heartbreaking. It's so beautiful. And it's probably my favorite thing that I've done because it just paints this tapestry of parents who want to connect with their kids. Yeah. And it's so difficult. And to see him finally get something right, it's great. It's a poor guy.
Yeah. Because he's always left hanging in some ways. He tells her, I love you, and there's no response. I love you, and there's no response.
Brutal.
It's brutal. There's another relationship, though, that's really important that I want to talk about, and that's his relationship with his partner, Nate, which is another, I have to say, beautiful relationship. And Nate could have given up on Jim.
And by rights,
should have. But for some reason, he does not, man. He is with Jim throughout, and it's a lovely relationship.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about the building of this relationship.
Yeah, so Nate is played by an actor buddy of mine named Nikan Robinson, and he is phenomenal.
Yeah, he
and
is.
I met him through Sundance. He was in the theater program at Sundance, and he's a lovely, lovely guy from Oakland, and we hit it off probably a year before we were shooting this. And I was like, I'm writing this character. I think you could be really good for it. And I don't know. The character is this endlessly forgiving friend.
Yeah.
And that's so moving to me. Like there's some kinds of friends in your life where it doesn't matter what you do, they're there for you. And like I had that when I was going through a divorce, and to see how my friends rallied around during this period, it's moving. It's this like masculine thing that happens, and I'm sure it happens with women as well, maybe even more poignant than it does with dudes. They usually just get drunk and smoke cigars in a backyard.
Yeah.
But there is something really poignant to that of like understanding what somebody's going through and helping them when they're going through hell. And yeah, there's a point in the movie where he absolutely should not help Jim out, and he's the only one to come over and help him out. It's great.
Yeah. He's berated his friend Nate, as you said. I mean, which should have ended the relationship in some ways, but as you say, and here's a moment from this, Nate comes over.
Judge is not a nice guy.
Yeah, that happens, man.
I'm sorry if I committed a hate crime against you.
Yeah, I forgive you.
Hey, why don't you come on downstairs with me, play some cards?
I don't know what I'm doing anymore. Cleaning the house. The vacuum cleaner stopped working. I turned it over, and it was all caught up in her hair. It was perfect. It looked just like the top of her little head. I kissed it. I kissed the vacuum cleaner.
It's great about these scenes too, is you don't know. I mean, they're sad, but they're funny as hell. Like, you know, and there's both of that going on, which is really great, I have to say. Like in that moment, but then you mentioned the backyard scene, which I found one of the most beautiful scenes in the film. Nate and Jim just go in the backyard. They smoke some cigars. They're playing baseball. And these moments with Nate just looking at him, and you get a sense that this is the best relationship he has in his life in some ways.
Yeah. Yeah, there's this moment, that moment where he looks at him, and it's like this him checking to make sure he's okay in a way that nobody else probably ever has. Didn't have a good relationship with his dad, didn't really know his dad very well. His mom's kind of on the lam. His wife left him. His daughter never makes eye contact with him. Mm-hmm. And there's this wonderful moment where Jim helps Nate fix his bat. It's like his son's bat, and he's like fixing it. And he says, you got to wrap it around here. They say a stitch in time saves nine. If you fix one thing once, you don't have to fix it nine times in the future. And Nate looks at him. And it's like he's fixing Jim right now. He's helping him out. And it's like that's why he came over. And it's this lovely little moment between the two of them in a backyard drunk. And it's funny. You don't really get – you wouldn't imagine that it would be a very poignant moment, but it is.
I wanted to ask you about a film that was really influential, Krisha, Trey Schultz film.
Yeah.
Would you talk about the first time you saw it in the theater?
Oh,
because
God.
It seems like it was a really powerful experience.
Dude, it was hell, man. My brother saved the voicemail of me calling him afterwards. If you haven't seen Krisha, go see Krisha. It's on Netflix now, and it's on iTunes. It is unbelievable. I saw it for the first time at South by Southwest 2015. It's March, and it's like a Cassavetes, Terrence Malick, P.T. Anderson movie shot in a backyard with the director acting in it and his whole family around him. And it's phenomenal. And Bill Wise, actually, the dude who plays the police captain in Thunder Road, is the uncle in Krisha. I stole him from Krisha. Yeah. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. But I saw that movie, And I realized that there was this renaissance happening of American filmmakers, particularly because there's no money in the arts in America, and they're able to run Kickstarter campaigns and make something that is that a studio can't make, something that's unsanitized. It talks about a big problem. Krish is about alcoholism and drug addiction, how it affects a family, and it's unbelievable. And it's a single location, and it's all done and told through performance and pacing and cadence, and it's wonderful. And I left the theater and cried for about 2.5 hours and walked around the river in Austin and called my brother, who had been in AA for 4 or 5 years, and just, you know, wept into a voicemail box saying, like, I'm sorry, I didn't appreciate how difficult it is to stop drinking, and I'm so proud of you. And it's like, that hit me. That movie hit me in a way that no other film had emotionally and comedically. It's a comedy. It's a funny movie.
Yeah.
But I realized that you can do that. You can if you care about something enough, you can make a movie with your friends and your family that will live forever, that will help people, that will convince people that they need to change. And that movie got me off the couch, and that's the reason I made the Thunder Road short film in the first place.
You said it's a revolutionary act to take hold of the elements of production.
To seize the means of production.
Yeah.
Absolutely, man. I think there's this daydream that filmmakers have that, you know, the anonymous entity of Hollywood is going to come along and help you out. But the incredible thing is that we have the same technology that they do. Like, you can shoot a movie on your iPhone now and win at Sundance. You can make a movie on your laptop, which is what I do all the time. Like, film is so democratized now, and if you just know how to use the programs and know how to use the camera, you are a movie studio. And don't listen to anybody that tells you otherwise.
I know you were part of this Sundance Creative Distribution Initiative, and I guess I'm interested in what the conversation is like among filmmakers who aren't going to make an Iron Man, you know, blockbuster, don't really want to. Then how do you get your films distributed? How do you get them shown? Like, what are the conversations that you're having? And, like, what are you thinking in terms of, like, platforms and how we get this stuff out there?
Well, yeah. So just to tell you our experience, we were able to get the film in theaters in America by calling theaters and by me tweeting about it and asking people to tag their favorite movie theaters or where they would see it. And that's how we got in touch with a lot of these theaters.
Wow.
And some of them said, yeah, we want that movie. It had won at a film festival. It won at South by Southwest, very luckily. And so we had some interest there. But we had probably like 20 or 30 theater opening in the United States, which is pretty cool. And then we opened in about 140 theaters across France and recouped our budget in the first, you know, 2 weeks of being in theaters. And so now we're carving out different territories. So we're selling the rights for distribution to Japan and Spain and Canada and several other territories by ourselves, like from my cell phone. And that's possible now. And that's really impersonating the job of an entire distribution company from an iPhone. And I can't tell you how incredible Sundance's creative distribution initiative has been. The team is very small. It's only about 4 people. And they are very smart and caring people. And it's their job to help out. And, I mean, yeah, that whole team, I cannot thank them enough. They've enlightened us in ways that I never imagined. And there's no turning back.
You mentioned the French. And, I have to ask, what is the deal with the French? They absolutely love this film. And I don't mean that rhetorically. What do you think the French see in Thunder Road that they love so much?
Yeah, so it's twofold. Thematically, with the movie, I think the French are very interested in what's going on in America behind the curtain. Instead of seeing the big blockbusters, the French have always loved American independent films. Like, John Cassavetes would release his movies in France first before going to the United States. I mean, you know, Vincent Gallo, Jerry Lewis, 1,000 people would make movies like that. The French are huge appreciators of that kind of stuff, and they love auteurism. Charlie Chaplin, they love people who are writers, actors, and directors at the same time. But really, they're very interested in what's going on in America, and there's something to watching an American authority figure who's drunk and clumsy that has a pistol that I think they laugh at politically and are also just interested in the mindset. And they're tackling the issue of toxic masculinity a lot better than Americans are. That's not really a conversation that comes up in America, but it happens all the time in France. And then legally, The rules are they were established by like Truffaut and Godard with the movie theater unions there, and there are cinemas on every corner. There's a cinema like in Paris. There's just a movie theater in walking distance anywhere you are, and the rules are that if a movie screens in a movie theater, it's not allowed to be on TV, on DVD, or on a streaming platform for at least 2 years. So if you don't see the movie in the cinema, you are left out of the water cooler conversation for like 2 years. So it creates this huge fear of missing out that culturally forces people to go to the cinemas. And it's a really interesting law. But that's why there's such a cinephile and appreciation of movies. I think there's like 15 or 20 movies that come out every week in France for that reason.
I want to play one more scene because it comes from something that you've talked about. And I just loved this idea that you build the scene around. And it was, I guess it was this poem that I actually found from William Meredith called The Illiterate.
Oh, dude.
Will you talk a little bit about this? And there's this scene where Jim and a colleague, a cop, pulls him over. Talk about this moment because I really liked this idea.
That's so funny you brought up the illiterate. So that's what the scene is. It's like this – it's Jim is driving his truck and gets pulled over after he's been fired. And he doesn't know why he's getting pulled over. And he closes the door behind him and realizes that he's locked himself out of his car. And the officer doesn't give him much information. And because he doesn't have enough information, Jim is forced to imagine the absolute worst, which is what The Illiterate is about. It's a poem where this guy gets a letter and he's illiterate and he doesn't know if it's – he imagines it's his brother who's died at war or his, you know, his sister's has a baby. And so he imagines all of these terrible things at once because he's unable to read, and he has to wait for his wife to come home and tell him that it's fine because she knows how to read. And it's this – really poignant depiction of humanity and everything that can be conveyed in a letter, and in this case it's a phone call.
What's going on? I'm sober. Hey, it's me. I'm sober. What's going on?
Pick up your phone.
What?
Your phone. Pick up your phone.
What's going on? I've been drinking.
They're trying to call you.
I'm locked out. I locked myself out of my car, I guess. What's going on?
They just sent me to...
Oh, you don't know? F***ing find out. Why would you pull me over if you don't know? What's going on? Why do they need me? God damn it. It's my house. What's your name again? Doug? Doug? God damn. Ow. Ah. You got a stick? Hey, you got a stick?
Yep.
How do I get? All right, does it have a little coupon on it? God damn. It's dead. The battery life on these f***ing things.
270 Winthrop?
That's my wife's house. 270? That's my wife's house.
I want to ask you about one moment. I won't give anything away in the final scene. He's looking for redemption, and there's this facial expression that sort of ends the film. And I just wanted you to talk a little bit about the role that Jim's face plays in this film, because it's really important. And we see, not in dialogue, sometimes the most powerful moments are just his face.
Yeah. That's what's so awesome about language. You can have a guy start to say something and then furrow his brow and shake his head. And then that says, man, I wish I hadn't said that out loud. And that's so funny. Like, you don't need dialogue in that. And like, that's something that they don't teach you in screenwriting classes, that it can just be a simple facial expression or a mannerism or, you know, anything that, you know, is a certain movement that says everything in the scene, how you convey the interpersonal conversations. It's part of language is the facial expression. The movie ends, and it's my favorite thing I've ever done on this planet. That last scene of this movie is unbelievable, and there's no dialogue.
So Jim's mom, coming full circle, Jim's mom was a dancer, and she ballet dancer, and she died, and he does this elaborate dance at her funeral in the opening scene. And then his daughter is being a jerk to him, and we find out through a scene with his sister that his grandfather took his mom to see Swan Lake when she was a kid, and that's what made her want to become a dancer. It's this throwaway line in the middle of this dialogue with his sister when he goes to visit her. And then the ending of the film is him taking his daughter to the Nutcracker, and she's pissed off. She doesn't want to go, and she's not into it at all. And then we watch these dancers dance on the stage, and they're incredible. And it cuts to Jim, and he's in the crowd. It's one shot, and he smiles and laughs because this girl has like done this incredible dance move. And then he looks kind of nervous, and he looks over at his daughter, and she sits up in her chair wide-eyed with her mouth open and like puts her head against the chair in front of her. And she's enthralled by it. And then the camera comes back to Jim, and he's like, man, I did a good job here. I think, you know, I did a pretty good job being a parent. And then he realizes that it's full circle. His grandfather did the same thing for his mom. And sorry, I'm crying right now. And he just breaks down. And it's this the one time that he's done the right thing, and it's the legacy of parenting. And it's beautiful. And you're watching this guy watch something on the stage and lights hitting his face, and he's surrounded by people, and he's crying and laughing at the same time for his daughter, and he closes his eyes, and that's how we end the movie. And to see it with an audience, to see it with people in a theater, and they're crying and laughing at this moment, it is like this mirror, and you never get that. It's so rare in cinema these days to like actually be connected to somebody on a human level. Yeah, it's really cool. It's a really great ending to a movie with no dialogue. You don't need it.
That's Jim Cummings. He wrote, he directed, and he stars in Thunder Road, which we're going to be screening next week as part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. It's going to be next Wednesday night at 7 o'clock. The film is going to be followed by a Q&A. Jim Cummings will be there for that. So get all the details at our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Holly Vasek. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.